armor, firepower, mobility.
This is what we call the Iron Triangle, the essential components of the tank.
Please remember to like, subscribe, or click the little notification bell if you don't want to miss out on these videos. And I'd just like to say thank you to all our patrons for making this possible. Please join them if you can.
In this episode, we're going to look at protection, and specifically the armour protection that allows the crew to get on and do their job. Now, as the threat changes, the nature of the protection is going to need to change as well. So the armour of tanks today is a totally different creature to that of 100 years ago. Now, this is a massive, complicated subject, and all we can give you here is an overview. So if there's anything you think we've missed out or anything you'd like to hear more about, please leave a comment below. The original spec for tanks in World War I was for a machine gun destroyer. Now, what that is a vehicle that can get across no man's land, flatten the barbed wire, win the firefight, and allow the infantry through to clear the enemy trenches. These vehicles had to be well enough protected to withstand small arms fire, that's rifle and machine gun fire. So what we've got here is 8 to 12 millimetres of hardened steel plate, and it is riveted construction. Now, this is a Mark II tank. This is actually the last surviving example. And this vehicle saw action at Arras in the spring of 1917. And what we have here is some battle damage, because you've got machine gun fire, which has been directed at what's perceived to be a weak spot, the commander and the driver's vision ports. Now, you can see here the rounds have impacted, but they haven't penetrated. Now, I actually think these guys were extremely lucky, because this is not armour plate. It's just boilerplate. It hasn't been hardened. The Mark IIs, they're designed as training tanks. But we're so desperate for tanks on the battlefield by the spring of 17 that the training tanks are sent over as well, despite the fact they don't have armour protection. Now, the German army very quickly realises they need a weapon that the infantry can use against tanks. And they experimented a little. They produced a 7.65mm armour-piercing round. That's basically a rifle or machine gun round. It's called the SMK, the Spitzmittkern. And it's essentially, it's a rifle round, but the lead core has been replaced with tooled steel. That works up to a point. But then the Mark IV tank comes out, and that's got thicker armour, so it's not so effective. So the next solution they came up with was one of these. Now, this is a T-Patrona, a tank round. And this is a 13.2mm round, so it's actually bigger than 50 cal. Initially, they wanted to build a machine gun for this, something called the T-Fgewehr, Tank- und Fliegergewehr. And that was a weapon you could use against tanks, you could use against aircraft. But they had difficulty getting that into production. So the next thing they'd do is to go to Mauser and say, right, there's the round, build a weapon around it. And this is what they came up with. This is the T-Gewehr, the tank Gewehr. And it is a huge, enormously heavy 13.2mm single shot bolt action rifle. Now, this will penetrate tank armour, but in order to do that, you've got to get within perhaps 100 metres. The tank presumably is going to see what you're up to and will do something about it. And this is just, it's a thoroughly nasty weapon. It's huge, it's heavy, its recoil is savage, and there's no butt plate there or anything like that to limit that. So it's a beast to fire, it really is. In my opinion, this is a suicide weapon, because when it comes down to it, it's single shot, bolt action, slow to fire, and the odds on even this round doing significant damage to a tank are probably fairly slim. So using this weapon, as I said, you know, it's just about suicidal. So this won't work. They used it with some success shooting out sniper plates in trenches, but against tanks, well, if we go around to the back of this vehicle, I'm afraid there is a very hard and nasty truth for you to see. Now, as I said earlier, this tank saw action at Arras in 1917. It was hit by shell fire and afterwards recovered from the battlefield. And there's pretty dramatic evidence of that that you can see here. Just down here, we have where the shells have hit the vehicle, actually entered. So they're coming in there. Then they don't stop. They go right the way through this left-hand horn, and you've got some exit holes here and corresponding dents in this side. So this is where they finally run out of steam and dropped into the mud. Now, this is where he began to realise that even if this were proper armour plate, 12 mil of metal does not provide protection against shell fire. And that one in particular, if that had been just slightly further in that direction, that would have gone inside the tank. It would have set off a petrol tank, ammunition inside. There'd have been a cataclysmic explosion, and the tank and its crew would be destroyed. Creating armour that could withstand shellfire, particularly of the emergency of tank versus tank warfare and more sophisticated anti-tank guns, was going to be the all-consuming need of the first few decades of the tank's existence. As we move into the interwar period, tanks are changing. They are becoming faster, more mobile. We're getting traversable turrets. Tank guns are improving in terms of power, and we have more effective armour-piercing rounds. In terms of construction, most of it is still riveted, as you can see from the Mark E here and the Medium Mark II, both built by Vickers. But we're also starting to see different constructional techniques, and we're specifically looking at welded and cast construction. One of the best examples we have of cast construction is this M4A1 Sherman from 1944. This was built by the Presteel Carco of Chicago, and as you can see, the whole of the upper hull is one huge cast component.
The advantage of casting is that it produces a strong rounded form, which is better in terms of deflection and doesn't have the inbuilt weaknesses in the form of joints that riveting or welding produce. The disadvantage is the production process is expensive, difficult, and requires a huge amount of skill to get right. Producing a mould, pouring the metal, and cooling are all complex and highly skilled processes in making a casting this size, and they are very easy to get wrong.
The process is also slow, which is a real problem in wartime when production needs to be ramped up. Now, the alternative to casting is welding. And here we've got a really good example on the Sherman Crab. Welding as a constructional technique was pioneered by a Swedish company called Landsverk in the 1920s. And they produced a range of mainly light tanks and armoured cars. Welding has got the advantage. It's still quite a complex process, but it's a little bit simpler, and it's certainly quicker than trying to produce huge cast components. And if you take the Sherman as an example, 8 out of 12 marks of Sherman have welded as opposed to cast hulls. Although there's another 2 that combine both techniques, because the M4 composite and the M4A6 have cast components at the front of the hull, and then the rest of it is welded. With armour, there are a whole heap of complex variables that you really ought to consider. I mean, the quality and composition of the armour, which can vary quite a bit, especially in wartime, and whether it's face-hardened or rolled homogeneous. But we're getting into quite deep waters here, and I think we'd better save that for another time.
The other big consideration with armour is weight. Steel is obviously heavy, and to keep the weight down, you need to concentrate the protection where it's needed. the front and the turret, where incoming fire is most likely to hit. Looking at the basic M4 Sherman, the front of the turret is 76mm thick, and the glacis is 51mm, down to 12mm underneath the hull.
The Sherman is not particularly heavily armoured, and certainly in later marks they had to beef up the degree of protection. But even the basic gun tank, and I know this one is a flail, even the basic Sherman gun tank weighs around about 28 tonnes.
Weight is obviously a major thing when you start looking at tanks as heavy or heavier than the Tiger. More armour obviously increases protection, but it impacts mobility and speed because the tank is heavier. So in turn, you need a more powerful engine, which in turn uses more fuel and limits range. It just goes on.
Tiger 1 at 56 tonnes is, you know, so that's quite a heavy tank for its time. But as the war goes on, German designers become fixated with ever bigger, heavier tanks with more powerful guns, until you get really quite ludicrous vehicles like this, the Jagdtiger. Now, at 72 tonnes, sheer weight makes this really mechanically unreliable. And if it breaks down, it can't be recovered, it's just too heavy. So they had to use demolition charges to blow these things up in situ. On vehicles where the armour protection wasn't that good, engineers and sometimes the tank crews themselves would add material to try and improve it. It's a process we call up-armouring.
At its most basic, crews would carry out field modifications, piling on stuff like spare track links, sandbags, chicken wire, and even just timber. Some Sherman crews also poured concrete over the glacis of their tanks to add a bit more protection. There's not much evidence that stuff like this worked, although it boosted crew morale, but some officially sanctioned up-armouring was certainly more effective.
Here on the Tank Museum's Panzer I, you can see two large slabs of armour being added on the front of the vehicle and on the glacis. This is quite common in the lighter sort of German tanks where the original armour wasn't that thick. This was an interesting one because it started off as an ordinary Panzer I turreted tank, gun tank, and then it was converted to a Kleiner Panzer Befehlswagen, which is a light command tank, and it was knocked out and captured in North Africa. Now that extra armour might have done some good, but as you can see when you look at battle damage here, the original armour really wasn't proof against even a light anti-tank round. This is the Panzer IV, and this is a bit of an unsung hero really. This is a real workhorse for the Panzerwaffe. It's a pre-war design that makes it right the way through to the end of World War II in frontline service, but with a very high degree of modification. The Panzer IV has been very substantially up-armoured, and some of the obvious stuff here on the front round the hull machine gunners and especially the driver's vision ports, but there's also extra bits of armour that have been bolted all over the place. And then you come to these things. Spaced armour around the turret, and there would originally have been these things called shirts and aprons down the side of the tank. They've gone, unfortunately, but you see the fittings where they were. Now, this is fairly light armour, but what it's all about is protection against the Soviet use of an anti-tank rifle. Now, as it was originally built, this is a pre-war design, remember, the armour along the side of the vehicle is only about 30 mil, and an anti-tank rifle round will penetrate that. But they've added this extra armour on. Doesn't need to be particularly thick, but what happens is the round hits it, it's damaged, it drops, it loses energy, and it won't penetrate the hull itself. Up-armouring, and also up-gunning the Panzer IV, extends its service life quite dramatically. And what you have here is that relatively rare thing. This is a pre-war tank design that is still in frontline service in 1945. Up to the mid-1930s, Tanks are basically big steel boxes. They're just about rectangular in design. But here, with the Soviet T-34, we start to see some different ideas, some different concepts. So you can see that the armour on front, sides, even the rear of the vehicle, is raked back. Now, this does two things. Firstly, it increases the likelihood of a ricochet, but it also increases the amount of metal that an incoming round's got to get through, and therefore it decreases the likelihood of penetration.
If armour is tilted back at 45 degrees, then 100 millimetres of metal becomes 140 millimetres, but without any increase in weight to the vehicle. The main disadvantage is that because the armour is canted back, the amount of room inside the tank is reduced severely, and the fighting compartment particularly becomes very cramped. Nevertheless, the design of the T-34 was hugely influential, and the lessons learned led to tanks like the German Panther.
World War II is really the period when the tank comes of age. Massive improvements in armour protection, in firepower, and in mobility. And in armour terms, we go from perhaps 6 to 14 millimetres on this British cruiser tank, as much as 250 mil on the Ag Tiger. This is entirely driven by adversarial considerations. What is the enemy going to throw at us, and how do we counteract it? After World War II, with the onset of the Cold War, old arguments reignite about what is the best combination. Firepower versus mobility versus protection. The Cold War is the era of the MBT, the main battle tank. But here you've actually got different approaches. Now, there are some NATO designers, like the guys who produced the French AMX and this, which is the West German Leopard 1. They're arguing that modern anti-tank munitions are so effective that no amount of extra armour protection will suffice. You've got to rely on speed and mobility. So that's a lighter, faster tank. The British approach, though, is the opposite. We've got the Chieftain here. And what that's all about is heavy armour protection and a big, powerful gun. But it does begin to impinge on people that no amount of extra armour is really going to suffice. We've got to think of higher tech solutions, and we are gradually edging towards what we today call composite armour. The British Chieftain is a vehicle that's in service for really a very long time, from the early 1960s well into the 1990s. And it does have quite a number of modifications in that time. One of those is a degree of up armouring. Now, it starts with ordinary cast steel armour, but then in the later marks, we have blocks of this stuff called steel brew added on, and they're on the front of the turret, either side of the gun, and then down towards the driver's hatch and the glacis. It's a bit crude by modern standards, but for the time, it was quite effective. It would act to deform armour-piercing rounds coming in, and it was also reasonably effective against high-explosive anti-tank. Like I say, a bit crude by modern standards, but it did add an extra degree of protection.
So far, so good. But tank guns and rounds improved, and with the advent of finned darts made of tungsten or depleted uranium, travelling at 3,000 metres a second, armour needed to adapt again.
The first new generation composite armour used by the British Army was Chobham, and it's named after the military vehicle experimental establishment in Surrey, where it was developed. That was used on Challenger 1, and then its successor, Dorchester, was used on Challenger 2. This is a Challenger 2. This is the British Army's current main battle tank. This type of armour is a high-tech sandwich of different materials. Steel, ceramic tiles, complex polymers all bonded together. The exact formula is secret, of course, but What happens is that an incoming round will strike. It'll hit the outer steel layer. It'll penetrate that, but it will then hit a layer of ceramic tiles.
These will shatter, but will also cause the energy of the round to be dissipated and the round itself to be abraded. Other layers underneath will continue the process and the round will be stopped. This also works against shaped charge rounds. These work by detonating on the armour and focusing a jet of white-hot molten metal and explosive residue onto the armour, which punches its way through.
Because the ceramic tiles form a jagged, irregular hole, the jet can't form. You'll also see that the shape of modern tanks like this Challenger 2 has changed. They're a lot more angular, a lot more slab-sided. Now, the reason for this is that composite armour is produced in flat sheets, flat units. They can't be easily bent or shaped. The advantage of it, though, is that those units are actually hung on the structure of the tank. They're not an integral part of it. So if one unit is damaged, it can be reasonably easily taken off and replaced. But it's not all high tech. British vehicles, British Army vehicles that served in Iraq and Afghanistan have commonly been fitted with this stuff. This is bar armour. It's sometimes known as slat armour. And it's designed to protect the vehicle against one of the most commonly used weapons in the world, the RPG, the rocket-propelled grenade. This literally traps the round and stops it hitting the vehicle. If you're lucky, it will also pinch off this detonator and it'll stop the round exploding. The problem with bar armour, though, is that it adds weight, it adds bulk, and impedes the cross-country ability of the vehicle it's fitted to.
We're also starting to hear news of Russian tanks and APCs in Ukraine being fitted with bar armour on top to counteract anti-tank missiles. These are known as COPE cages, although the degree of success is debatable.
The type of armour you will commonly see most often on vehicles from the former Warsaw Pact is this stuff. And this is ERA. This is explosive reactive armour. They are steel boxes fitted to the outside of the vehicle, and there's an explosive charge inside. So if they're hit by an incoming round, that charge detonates, it forces the plates apart, and it neutralises the impact of the round. Now, this is most commonly seen on T-tanks like the T-72, the T-80, or on this British Armoured Personnel Carrier, the Bulldog. In this video, we've seen how tank crew protection evolves, mostly in tandem with developments in tank and anti-tank weaponry. From face-hardened steel plates, able to keep out machine gun fire if you're lucky, right the way through to much thicker armour which will protect you from high-velocity anti-tank rounds, to modern layered composite armour that will dissipate the energy of a high-velocity fin round or disrupt the formation of the blast from a shaped charge. What is certain is that as long as tanks continue to exist on the battlefield, huge efforts will go into protecting the vehicles and their crews from increasingly powerful anti-tank weapons. I do hope you've enjoyed this video. If you did, please subscribe. And if you can, support us on Patreon.